Right, thanks very much. This speech is called Lilith Before Eve, which is a bit of a joke title in a way, because in the Old Testament Apocrypha, Lilith is the mother of all evil and the mother of all demons and the mother of all vampires, and mythologically is Adam's first wife, and she's created from mud, unlike Eve, who's taken from the rib in mythology. So it's a joke title in a way, because I'm going to talk about feminism and about the feminist movement. Now, I'll dispense with the Shirley Williams idea about feminism, that it's just equal pay for equal measures and equal work done, that it's just a sort of form of generalised, prepackaged egalitarianism between the genders, because that's not very interesting. What I'm going to do in this talk is look at the most extreme and marginal elements in feminism, which you can't entirely categorise as left or right, because it's a movement off to one side by itself to a degree. And I'm going to look through them, probably going from the most extreme to more moderate examples of same. Now, what is the most extreme piece of New Wave feminism from the 1960s and 70s? Probably it's the Scum Manifesto. The Scum Manifesto, that's what it was called. Yes, the Society for Cutting Up Men, which is was published by Verso, which is New Left Books, as it once was. And was produced by Valerie Solaris, who was a sort of artistic lesbian in Andy Warhol's circle in relation to the Thatcherite movement. Now, she shot Warhol, actually, so she put theory into practice, because he wouldn't publish a play by her. In actual fact, it was quite a serious incident, because Warhol almost died and was never the same again afterwards, according to people who were associated with him during that period. She also wounded two other people, but because she was a paranoid schizophrenic, she got 3 years in prison. She later surrendered to a policeman that very same day. Now, the Society for Cutting Up Men, which was her own abstraction, was a piece of extreme misandry, which is not really heard of very much, but which is the opposite of misogyny, and it's extreme hatred of men. During this context of this text, the Solaris advocated the eradication of men as a gender, who she described as having a perverse chromosome which makes us unfeminine and therefore differentiated. Now, this text, which is still available in very alternative left-wing bookshops, those of the left, is probably the most extreme and sort of delusional, counterfactual, and virtual reality piece of feminism that was ever created. It's quite a literate text. It's not sort of just belly-aching ranting. It also talks about the entire restructuring of society and deals with, essentially, lesbian separatism or female-female bonding away from heterosexual norms or family-based societies as traditionally supposed. Separatism is actually a key part of the more biological elements in the feminist movement. Feminism has achieved most of its mainstream goals, which is why the WLM, the Women's Liberation Movement, has largely been curtailed. Also, the 60s generation of radicalised students that provided most of the camp followers have themselves, have themselves grown old and long in the tooth. Some people may know that there's a separatist feminist bookshop on the Charing Cross Road called Silver Moon, which traditionally doesn't like men to go in it. And so when the odd male student on a dare and that sort of thing goes into Silver Moon, there is a prescribed policy to be as frigid, to be as hostile, and to be as nasty as possible until the man leaves, because they can't deny male entry into the shop under equality law, which of course technically feminism is actually in favour of. So you have this reverse principle going on there. Now, separatism of the Solaris type is very extreme and very radical, and was disputed by other feminists, of course, such as socialist feminists and certain Marxist feminists who don't necessarily believe that men are the enemy. So-called rooted or biological feminism, which actually is not a biological discourse, it's a discourse about biology, perceives an endless gender war and a conflict between men and women in all social areas. Radical feminism is the term that's usually given to this tendency. The issue of lesbianism, in a sense, has to be dealt with because there are two types of lesbianism in relation to this type of politics. The first is so-called political lesbianism, where a woman doesn't have those desires herself, but because of a rejection of patriarchy refuses Congress with men, and therefore has two options, either inversion or lesbianism or celibacy. So the idea of political lesbianism grew up in the 1960s and 70s in the women's liberation movement, although later was questioned by the majority of democratic and socialist feminists who believed that if women had a majority instinct to be heterosexual, that was all right as long as they entered into non-patriarchal relations with men. That was ultimately, democratically, the majority tendency that the women's liberation movement adopted. But separatist currents have always existed, and there is the concept of a lesbian nation, as it's called. Lesbian Nation, which was quite a well-known feminist book in the 1970s, posits the twin-track strategy for lesbianism in a political context. The other is, of course, women who are born inverted and who are born that way and who adopt lesbianism as a norm. But they would be a minority of the activists who advocated complete surrender to the world of matriarchy and so complete avoidance of Congress and intimacy with men on all fronts. Radical feminism also was very keen on the abortion of males, particularly after abortion was achieved in most, largely due to social democratic and liberal pressures in the 1960s and thereafter. Abortion was, of course, achieved in law. It had always existed in the back streets, but had never become an ordered part of the health services of Western Europe and North America until the social and cultural revolutions of the 1960s, and was militantly supported by all feminist movements. Indeed, abortion is a key issue for mainstream second-wave feminism, because it deals with autonomy, the autonomy of the female without male coercion or control, and the extreme individualism, but without femininity, is at the core of many of these movements, and is actually probably the tendency that draws together anarchist feminists, radical feminists of a biological, semi-biological type of the sort that I've enunciated, socialists, Marxian and communistic feminists, and their more mainstream liberal equivalents. There are people who basically say that even the Margaret Thatchers of this world have a feminist element to them, because after all, women have to have the vote and have to be able to engage in political activity for somebody to rise to be the leader of a centre-right political party, such as she did in the mid-1970s, becoming premier, first female premier in Britain's history a couple of years thereafter. But for the purposes of this analysis, I'll exclude that normative talk whereby very, very mainstream liberal humanist demands are conflated in with the feminist movement, which regarded them as just the softest edge of their more radical currents. One of the most famous feminists in the 1970s and 80s, who received acreage of print on her death a few years ago, was Andrea Dworkin. Andrea Dworkin, who was an obese individual, wrote a series of quite famous books, of Pornography, Men Possessing Women, a book on right-wing conservative female activists in the Republican Party in the United States called Right-Wing Women, and certain quite scatological novels, actually, such as Fire and Ice, and various other works of what she called explicit anti-pornography. One of the great failures of the feminist movement that has succeeded in many other areas is their campaigns against pornography in the sex industry. Socialist feminists, fearful of the accusation of puritanism, have tended to shy away from some of those discourses, but feminism as a whole is deeply opposed to the commercialisation of sexuality and to the commercialisation of the female image as a result of that. In the 1960s, a whole potpourri of different left libertarian and other demi-Trotskyite notions came up, and some of them were in conflict with each other. Sexual libertarianism and extreme freedom and extreme hedonism clashed violently with the neo-Puritanism of quite a lot of the feminist movement. In their campaigns and strictures against pornography, from Page Three in the Sun through to so-called and alleged snuff movies and everything in between, feminism has distinctively failed. It's failed to make any inroads on the commercial activities of pornographers. It's failed to decrease the profitability of these areas. People will be aware that large parts of the British print media are now owned by pornographers or ex-pornographers, as the fortunes of these people have been mainstreamed since Raymond and Sullivan and others started these businesses over 40 years ago. Again, allowed to do this by the social reforms of the 1960s. Many feminists used to have Reclaim the Night marches, as they used to call them. Reclaim the Night, where they used to go around with candles and various torches late at night, particularly in the sort of pornographic or sin bin areas, the red zones that exist in all cities. There's one in London, of course, sort of equidistant with the streets around a particular district of Soho. It's probably about a quarter of a mile square. And traditionally, feminist marches used to go around these areas. Sometimes actions would be engaged in which are socially and civically illegal, such as the supergluing of the locks of various pornographic bookshops and film distributed agencies and that sort of thing. One of the more interesting corollaries is that the feminist movement took a very radical turn in Northern Europe or Scandinavia simultaneously with the commercialisation of the hardest type of pornography in those same countries. So you see a culturally schizoid phenomenon going on there, where the 60s lead amongst their people who came out of them in quite contrary and diverse directions. You see one tendency of opinion, militant feminism, that wants to close the sex industry down and does not regard it as a legitimate form of capitalist enterprise. This is irrespective of criticisms when they have capitalism more generally. And you also have an enormous range of left libertarian and more liberal spokesmen and women who regard pornography as essentially legitimate. But it is interesting that feminism has had an utter defeat there. Although most far-left movements retain a certain puritanism in relation to sex industry issues, the Trotskyist left, on the whole, regarded the emotional pornography that women read, and romance fiction and that sort of thing, as on a par with male pornography, and hates to make moral judgments of a bourgeois character. But most traditional communist movements, if they can be described as traditional, most authoritarian and Stalinoid-type movements, banned pornography, as indeed the Soviet Union did, basically from the Stalinist period after Trotsky was defeated internally in the internal battles with Stalin after 1928. The Soviet Union is an interesting example of the sexual politics of the extreme left. Between 1918 and 1928, almost all inhibitions were flouted, at least in law, although the effect of that on Soviet life was more marginal. And almost every sexual tendency was permitted between about 1918 and 1928. You moved from a czarist, conservative, and highly socially authoritarian, conventionalist and conservative apparatus to almost complete libertarianism in these areas. One feminist that was very important for the Bolshevik movement was Alexandra Kolsonai, who was an ex-aristocrat who later became ambassador to Mexico, partly to get her out of the Stalinist purges, and was regarded as a Bolshevik heroine, not least for because of her taste in young Soviet sailors of a battleship Potemkin type. Now, she wrote a quite well-known novelised state socialist fiction called Dream of Worker Bees, I think, in which men and women live in spartiate-type communes and don't intermarry with each other and engage in what is called free love. The doctrine of free love between men and women, in other words, no traditional family structure, no monogamy, no heterosexual bonding, and a more looser sort of infinite rather than finite relations, goes back to most forms of utopian leftism in the 19th century and underground and bohemian movements, and resurfaces in the 1920s, resurfaces again in the 1960s. Wyndham Lewis, who's a modernist right-wing intellectual who's influenced me quite a lot in my life, had the theory that radical counterculturalism from the left has three phases in Western society in the last 200 years, although he never lived to see the third one. The first one is in the 1890s, in which you have an elitist zone of decadence, if you like, and bohemianism, radicalism. The next one is in the 1920s, the so-called Jazz Age, when there's a blowout culturally from the devastation of the Great War. You have a sort of endless party on easy credit that the Great Depression brings to an end in 1929-30. And that could be considered to be a bourgeois or a middle-class version of the more upper-class decadence of the 1890s. And the next great splurge is the baby boomer generation in the 1960s, who in a sense have a lower middle class, bourgeois and proletarian bohemia, a mass bohemia, based upon student activity and based upon all of the economic privileges which in a sense accrued in the post-war era and which are now being taken away. Because of course you could do degrees virtually for free then. You had several years to engage in radical critique of bourgeois society without really doing any meaningful work. Now students are £30,000 down just for a very moderate degree from an ex-polytechnic, as all degrees are commercialised along the American lines. And that's one of the reasons for the complete de-radicalisation of contemporary students, which is very noticeable. Apart from animal rights, some residual feminism and ecological activity, there's almost very little radicalism going on in the universities outside what certain radical Muslims get up to, watched by the security services. So the feminist movement influenced all forms of leftism, whether with the possible exception of the old Stalinist model with the Communist Party of Great Britain. But even then, the influence of anti-sexism, as it would be called, was palpable. Almost no institutional ideological tendency on the left was immune from feminist critique. And this changed attitudes on a whole range of issues, from property rights to divorce, from abortion to so-called child's rights, to the rearing of children, to attitudes towards pornography, to attitudes towards heterosexuality, and attitudes towards men. The broad socialist stroke humanist left never learned along with the idea that men are the enemy. There used to be, of course, in traditional feminist congresses and so on, chanting that men were the enemy. And if ever a boyfriend or husband or whatever turned up at the end of the meeting to take somebody home in a car, there would be quite a scene. So separatism was sort of enforced, but was also a dividing line between the very radical feminists and those of, if you like, a more assimilationist and more gradualist character. Like all movements, it was plagued with an enormous number of personality clashes and splits. And it had its star turns and star theorists who remained media characters and representatives of feminist opinion long after the movement had begun to dip down. The media had a schizophrenic attitude towards feminism. On the one hand, they were good copy, and feminist intellectuals and ideologues were given a lot of space. Probably the most famous ideologue in Britain of this type was Germaine Greer, whose book The Female Eunuch caused outrage and sensation in various ways. She was an Australian don who now teaches, I think, at Oxford, and has been through several permutations. Indeed, her theory is dialectical. The first book was a very radical piece of feminism, almost on the cusp of the all men are rapists ideology that Marilyn French disseminated through her novel The Woman's Room. A lot of this material was very mainstream. In the 1960s, 70s and 80s, you could get it from Smiths. This is the one thing that's interesting about the feminist movement, the belief that women wanted this material, and that certain dissentient left-wing men even wanted this material, at least wished to peruse it, was very much of the moment. This material was available in the women's section in most, not newsagents, but most mainstream bookshops. This was, you didn't have to go to obscure sources to obtain this material. And although the number of people who ever read this material was very small, its influence in the general culture has been very pervasive. Probably no movement has influenced society in a soft power way than feminism since the Second World War. Unlike almost any other tendency of opinion, its erosion of traditional and patriarchal structures, to use its own terminology, has been very extensive and very deconstructive, and it has almost, to use a 17th century phrase, turned the world upside down in 50 to 60 years. If you consider that all laws in relation to divorce, in relation to abortion, in relation to pornography, in relation to most mainstream male-female relations, and most of those relations per se, were the opposite, or slightly less tendentiously, the semi-opposite of what they are now, before I was born. I was born in 1962. In 1962, abortion was illegal, divorce was very difficult to come by, contraception was difficult and highly medicalised and somewhat obscure. Relations between men and women were quite traditional. Mass mainstream pornography and the growth of the so-called sex industry and its invasion of all other medias, because one of the tricks is the contemporary media resembles the pornography now of the 1960s and 70s. Because the pornographicization of mass media is again one of the most salient factors which has occurred in the last 40 to 50 to 60 years. It's almost a shock to point it out now, because the process has become so all-encompassing and so gradually attainable that the fact that Cosmopolitan is as extreme as most forms of male soft pornography now, which it certainly wasn't when it started, whereas the sort of pornography that Playboy once represented, in other words, very soft, is now so mainstream that it's almost on the television nightly. So one can argue that the forces of the counterfactual sexual revolution of the 1960s have not been in women's interests at all. And there are certain dissident feminists who turn back to slightly more conservative social positions later in life, usually, who sometimes ruefully admit that this is the case. Probably the destructivity of the feminist movement, particularly the second wave from the 60s and 70s, is seen in the enormous divorce rate and the enormous non-marriage rate which now exists. The deconstruction and whittling down and whittling out of the society like a piece of sort of wooden sculpture is well underway. No politician now can criticise the single-parent family because so many people are involved in them and they are so much part of the constituent electorate to which one has to appeal. Marriage itself has been relativised almost to a point of semi-invisibility within the culture, although there are still quite strong ideological pressures to keep it as a gold standard or as an ideal. But the very difficulty that a policy as tame as giving tax breaks or exemptions to married families that the Cameron government has tried to instigate around the margins shows you the difficulty in a lone area of ploughing back on what has occurred in all other areas. The radical social, sexual and libertarian agendas of the 1960s ramified with feminism in various ways, and yet never lived up to the utopianism of the feminist movement. Feminism remains, in some respects, particularly in its second generational aspect, a utopian movement, a belief in total transformation of woman, of man, and of social and civic and lived circumstances. One of feminism's radicalisms is the idea that the personal is the political. When people, when they leave a room like this, or whatever tendency of opinion they support, drop their politics away from them in their private life or in the way in which they actually live their own life. That would be true of many people who have even quite pronounced political views. Feminism is based on the idea that everything that one does, from the smallest into family relationship and so on, is actually deeply political. And the belief that the personal is political, and that the personal is even more important in its politicisation than what is customarily regarded as politics, certainly electoral politics, has had enormous soft power gains. By soft power, I mean cultural power, the ability that feminism has had retrospectively to engender terror in normal relations where quite ordinary and normal people without any ideology at all weigh sexism and weigh whether one remark was more sexist than another as a criterion of social acceptability. Few people would have heard of these terminology before the 1960s or the 1970s. Today, in certain areas of employment, it's quite a serious matter to be accused of institutional sexism or to be accused of sexism per se. And as with the corollary racism, an enormous bureaucracy has grown up to police, particularly academic discourse. There's a sort of 1984 or Orwellian element to this, where in the academic life, where people are mentally trained for the attitudes that they will carry through as educators in the future, people are taught the correct responses in a post-religious, secular and multicultural age. An enormous number of university lecturers have got into trouble over a sort of feminist and a PC agenda to such a degree now that many will only interview female students with the door open or with a woman colleague present in case they're accused of making a remark of a detrimental, objectifying, patriarchal or sexually genocidal character. This can be quite an innocent and freeborn remark in relation to what will be regarded as old-fashioned masculinity. But old-fashioned masculinity is something that's probably not too much to be found in many institutions of higher learning. Traditional colleges were segregated along gender lines. Traditional Oxford and Cambridge colleges were segregated along gender lines. Certainly there were single-sex female colleges well into the 1980s. Again, a strange byproduct of the feminist success is the deconstruction of old-fashioned all-female institutions, many of which were actually in female interests. So, feminism's successes have been multiple, but the detriment to society as a whole has been massive. Unhappiness, or happiness, can never really be measured. But from a personal or subjective way of looking at things, I would not characterise this as a particularly happy or successful era, or a particularly happy or successful culture. I think the fact that almost everyone, one in two marriages is now ending in divorce, and there's an enormous amount of dissatisfaction, which in some respects the two genders may have with each other. Many of these issues are not discussed, and feminism and male reactions to feminism, some of which have not been too brilliant, are actually part and parcel of many of the ongoing problems in this age. I think childlessness, radical single living, the decline in the family as a model, intergenerational decline, whereby the idea is your grandparents looked after the children and that sort of thing, rather than hired help, and that you didn't necessarily need two incomes in order to survive in an average mortgage property, which is now no longer the case, have all contrived to bring about feminist victories in ways that undercut the utopianism that that movement once espoused. Is feminism a left-wing movement? Only in part, although it's very difficult for the right to agglomerate its ideas in with certainly second wave or second generation feminism. Yet traditionally, the gender and the politics and the politics of the personal being all pervasive is something for which Marxism has little time. Only post-dated non-Stalinist and Trotskyite types of Marxism were able to meld sexual, political, anthropological and environmental concerns in with themselves. Traditional Marxism has had no time for these bourgeois deviations. Green politics is of no account. Industrialisation is a moral good in accordance with mainstream Marxism. Similarly, semi-biological ideas about women have no place in an order which is totally socially ameliorated and understood as such. So traditionally, Marxism had little time for feminist politics, although acceding to radical female wishes in relation to the restructuring of society, such as occurred in the Soviet Union after 1917. The interesting thing which occurred is that despite the lifting of almost all psychological, social and familial restrictions between 1918 and 1928, Soviet life did not change particularly dramatically, partly because most people were struggling to survive, and these legal changes only had marginal impacts. After 1928, everything was reversed, and Stalin introduced a form of neoconservatism in the personal and political area. Family life was re-encouraged. After the Second War, the enormous devastation inside the Soviet Union meant that motherhood was prized. Women who had over 10 children and contributed to feelings of Soviet warriorship and providing men to work in factories and so on were given medals by the state. Everyone knows the extreme prudery of the communist bureaucracies in post-war Eastern Europe, far more extreme than their Western equivalents. Indeed, the media in traditional communist societies after the first revolutionary phase is over often resembles the Western media in the early part of the 20th century, when you actually had a conservative bias and you had a conservative society with a very small C rather than a liberal one tending to the left. So in my opinion, you have up until the 1950s in most Western societies, if you analyse the mass media, you have mainstream conservative small C attitudes, whereas after that you have mainstream left liberal and mildly libertarian social attitudes. This is why these radical movements cut very deep, but they never achieve entirely everything that they want. what they do is that they are the radical vanguards. They are the diamond drills. They are the teeth in the flesh that push the thing, push the unwieldy social contract in a particular direction. Without all of these radical movements, the enormous social, cultural and exhibitionistic changes which we've seen would not have occurred. Therefore, these radicals are themselves the splinters that give off the energy that corrals other tendencies of opinion and pushes them into the mainstream. These are the ideas that are then taken up by people in a very jaundiced and hazy way. But the very fact that a television executive could be sacked today for making a program that evinced the traditional values of the 1950s is emblematic of the fact that an enormous societal and structural and psychological set of changes has occurred. The breakdown of the women's liberation movement is partly due to the success of that tendency of opinion, despite many of the contradictions which were involved. The most famous British feminist publishing house is Virago, which was set up by a committee of women probably about 30-odd years ago now, quite late in the day. But most of the books that Virago produced were quite conservative literary works written by upper-class women between about 1890 and 1940. So you had this strange lag, basically, whereas the culture of the suffragettes was brought back by second-wave feminist publishing because that's what they had to publish. The key feminist text from the past is Mary Wollstonecraft's Rights of Woman, which is a feminist version of Tom Paine's. She, of course, was part of a famous, in that era, left-wing family, which consisted of Shelley, Mary Shelley, his second wife who wrote Frankenstein, and of William Godwin, the mild but evident political anarchist who wrote Political Justice. Now, the key texts in feminism move from a belief in equal rights to the exchangeability of men and women. One of the more radical, small r, feminist demands is that men are feminized to the degree that women are masculinized. This is an ultimate end in sort of egalitarian social pressures. Hence, all sorts of outrider movements have been supported that disprivilege traditional forms of masculinity. The deconstruction of the traditional heroic male images that accounted for most of Western media up until the 1950s and early 1960s is all part of that project. If you analysed Hollywood films even today, in comparison to what they were before 1960, you see a reversal which is almost an inversion, although strands of what was to occur later on were widely discernible, even going back to the 30s. But again, up until about 1960, the norms of a socially conservative culture survived. Britain in the 1950s is a world away from the society that we have now. Indeed, the libertarian left pressures are such that we've received a total inversion, or sort of psychological auto-mutilation, which has occurred between then and now. The interesting thing is that most people regard what exists now, they regard the content of the Daily Mirror on a daily basis as semi-normal. Whereas the Daily Mirror in 1960 was almost a completely different type of newspaper, a slightly socially conservative, centre-left newspaper that supported anti-communist trade union leaders and the right wing of the Labour Party. Now you can argue that that Hugh Cudlip model, a sort of MI5 prescribed Labour model, which it was an establishmentarian ploy of that era, but the content of mass media now is so unsubtle and so pervasive in its change as to exemplify all of the tendencies of opinion which won through in the 1960s and thereafter. The irony is that many of these vanguard movements would regard the popular media of today as a sink of iniquity. This is one of the paradoxes. Adorno and the Frankfurt School are totally critical of modern mass media, are totally critical of what they consider to be the cultural industry by which the masses are enslaved, and yet at the same time, the tendencies that they represented in a purified and vanguard form have broken through, albeit moderated and assimilated, to such a degree that they partly got what they wanted, but in a way in which they can never appreciate. It's almost as if everyone gets partly what they want and don't want, combined in equal measures. The only tendencies in the West that haven't gotten what they want at all are the radical right and various forms of religious foundationalism or fundamentalism, which remain outside the circle and are conceptually demonised because they cannot be assimilated. One of the radical ideas in the 60s and 70s, a post-Marxist idea, was a dark cultural notion of situationism. This is the idea that everything is mixed together and one has a society of the spectacle and of mass media and of postmodern interchange of image upon image and thought upon thought, almost with the instantaneity with which somebody can control their mobile phone or some WAP application on it. Now, this type of tendentious and voyeuristic media feeds on the sort of images and ideas that were released by the vanguard movements of the 60s and 70s, but they've been commercialised. This is the interesting thing which the feminist movement never realised, indeed sexual liberation movements in the 1960s never realised, that the commercialisation and the commercial exploitation of the body and all of its resources in mass advertising and elsewhere would be what would occur. There is a sense, an innocent-mindedness in a strange, purient way to these people and their ideas. They never thought that the beneficiaries of many of their notions would be pornographers like Raymond and Sullivan, who are traditionally villains or semi-criminal figures in a far-left lexicon. Indeed, the criminal, drug-dealing, prostitutory fringes of capitalism shading into criminality are traditionally stereotypical images of capitalist and centre-right evil in far-left terms. But the 60s introduced so many social waves and so many cultural changes that when Oz magazine and various other things broke taboos and were pleased to do so from a hippie or yippie sort of left student perspective, they never realised that the beneficiaries of this, these changes, would be the man who presently owns the Daily Express and the Sunday Express and related media. The Desmonds of this world are the monsters that have been created by the free-for-all in image and fact and the change in the reference points of sexual politics which the 60s introduced. It's the one again of, I once visited the, for my sins, the National Union of Students building in Manchester on the Oxford Road, and they had a newsagent there, and it was the most puritanical newsagents I'd ever been in. Usually when you go in a newsagent, even if you just want stamps or something, you know, there's an enormous wall of flesh, essentially, even in the more moderate titles, which superficially have little to do with sexuality, because that's how things are marketed today. Before 1960, they wouldn't have been marketed, certainly not quite in that way. And yet there was none of this at all in this NUS prescribed building, because they had been through every tendency of opinion, from innocent listings magazines in Manchester right the way out to the fringes, and everything had been judged in accordance with how objectificatory, how masculinist, how stereotypical, how patriarchal with a large P, all of this media had been. And that which fell on one line of this particular sort of red line went into the dustbin or was returned, and that which was regarded as acceptable, and there was hardly anything that was regarded as acceptable, actually. So there was almost a complete absence of media in this media shop. This is one of the great ironies of the entire development of what's gone on. There was an attempt about 20 years ago now to found a left-wing paper on Sunday called News on Sunday, which only lasted a couple of issues. And one of the problems that they had was capitalisation and distribution and all the normal, rather boring things. But one of the internal reasons that it failed is because nearly all of the comment by quite traditional left-wing writers and famous left-wing cartoonists like Ralph Steadman was regarded as politically incorrect. Indeed, Steadman's quite German expressionist cartoons about Margaret Thatcher and so on, as they sort of looked, rather similar to Grosch and people in the 20s and 30s in Weimar Germany, who pioneered that type of very aggressive, graphic sort of illustration, was regarded as so sexist and anti-humanist and patriarchal that it couldn't be permitted. So what tends to happen is the left devours itself when it really gets going between the tendencies of a new form and newfangled censorship, which are very extreme, and tendencies of total anarchy, nihilism, and near depravity that wants to let everything rip and basically believes there are almost no standards and no limits at all, nor should there ever be. This tension that does exist, and which is still there in nearly all forms of feminist critique of media, plagues the left to this day. But what they're doing is they're arguing from a position of semi-victory, whereby each new film and each new magazine is considered in accordance with how correct and or incorrect it actually is. The criterion for correctness and incorrectness have also changed. The sort of so-called girl power culture of the 1990s, where teenage and sort of ladette women insisted that they wanted to be female in their own way, has also plagued havoc with some of these post-60s norms. In the realms of mass culture, wave follows wave, and standardized ethos from one era can be overthrown by new concepts and precepts that come up. There's been no attempt to roll the clock back to before the psychological and cultural changes of the 1960s. In this sense, feminism has achieved a partial victory. The interesting thing is how male structures of traditional ways of looking at things acceded to these wishes. Many men are deeply confused at the present time, and have been for several generations. And yet, because gender is biological, the recrudescence of core male and female attributes survives. Free-floating and irrespective of all theory. However, most men have acceded to feminist demands because they feel there's no alternative to them. To stand out against the culture of egalitarianism is to render yourself demonic. And this is particularly so in private relations. You'll often find that people are far more nervous of intruding their values into private relations where you can pay a considerable price if things go wrong. And this is where the idea that the personal is political is so extraordinarily powerful. It was said earlier on that one of the subtexts for this particular meeting is why are women not extraordinarily involved in right-wing politics? That's complicated. When right-wing political movements break through, a large number of women become involved. Success, power, the trappings of getting somewhere, all interest a significant part of the population, and interest everybody. Everyone begins to agree with you when you start to be successful. I remember when I attended the Red, White and Blue ones in Paris, the mainstreaming of that movement after some of its major electoral successes was quite evident. All politics is vanguard-led. You begin with small little groups that implant their ideas within the general culture. They have to engage in some intellectual prior positioning, otherwise it's just naked and empty populism, which becomes the jester politics of the fringe and ends up largely with an empty protest, and people who are elected in the end up in the mainstream parties, whether they like it or not, whether they even choose to join them or not. But if you do the intellectual prior positioning and you then break through on a crest of a wave that will always moderate the utopian demands that exist in any absolutist and radical tendency of opinion, you do begin to get somewhere. Feminism has now triumphed in the West in particular to such a degree that it's causing new convulsions with the mass of the immigrants who've come in, most of whom come in from socially conservative and or religiously defined cultures elsewhere in the world. One of the things that was most shocking to unassimilated to assimilated westernized immigrants is the social and cultural revolutions of the 1960s, which many of them, traditionally the older generations, just ignored and lived in their own mental space as if they weren't actually cohabiting the society in which these things had gone on. This is less so now, and what you see amongst younger immigrants is a dialecticism, whereby amongst the young, they either become very Western and reject their own parents, and reject the assumptions of their own communities. Or they engage in a militancy grounded in their own communities or grounded in their own faith systems. So people are either going back to the traditional structures in a more radical way without the social conservatism of the elders, or they assimilate completely into post-60s Western norms, which are now so pervasive that most people don't bother to reject them even in their own mind. Because to actually reject many of them, you would have to turn off mass media. You would have to engage in processes of alienation, in a way, from what now exists. And that's very difficult for many people. And nor do they wish to be regarded as odd, or socially reclusive, or corralled into a space, or ghettoised in their own life. The bulk of people conform to the energies and pressures that they now feel themselves living under. Wyndham Lewis wrote a text in 1926 called The Art of Being Ruled, and he said that the idea that women would go out to work and completely compete in a male way and on a male basis would be the most easy and requisite way to undermine the family that had ever been created, far more radical in its excesses than all of the feminist and left-wing marches put together. And this indeed is what has occurred. We live, as I've often said in these talks, in a strange hybridized society where the economics of the centre-right and the social, cultural and soft power prerequisites of the centre-left have fused and merged into a left-wing capitalism, which would have been regarded as absurd in the early part of the last century. When left-wing and right-wing intellectuals actually used to meet with each other, this hardly occurs today except in media set-piece battles, which are largely orchestrated from beforehand, and the results of which are unsatisfactory. When Chesterton and Belloc and Shaw and Wells used to actually have debates with each other in the early part of the 20th century, the idea that you would have ended up with a left-wing capitalism would have been regarded as utterly absurd. Utterly absurd. And yet this is what we have, because the market has realised that you can clear at the lowest common denominator level, and you can clear to a market expectancy of maximum profit by often pitching things at a low to middle common denominator, and that you never go bankrupt by underestimating the taste of the generality. Therefore you can always push things lower, and you can always achieve a maximum payout by making sure that the thing is tilted to the lowest common denominator, up to a point. And the lowest common denominator, you have to be careful to go too low, therefore you can become unacceptable and outside the frame of what is commercially convenient. But the tendency and the drift is always downwards. So you have egalitarianism, downwards drift, and the desire to make money of a maximum sort combined in a poisonous and rather noxious brew. And all over the economy, and don't forget we're living in a society where we make very little and everything is traded on services and secondary and tertiary forms of production and added value, fueled by debt and based upon an interchangeable, movable capital economy where the movement of labour, namely mass immigration, is just one tool in the general game. So we have a situation where the deconstruction of traditional ideas of masculinity and femininity and the disavowal of the idea that they're biologically based, even though many of the critics now believe that they may well be, is part and parcel of the atomized and alienated world with which we find ourselves surrounded. Feminism has thus done much of the groundwork and the spade work for radical forms of libertarian individualism that it doesn't really agree with, because much of the objectification of women that's resulted in mass media is something that feminism has been traditionally opposed to, and yet is inexorably led to. I also think that a lot of men have taken advantage of the choices and expectations that feminism has aroused, and that this has led to a general coarsening of relations between men and women, which has occurred. People don't like being done down or perceive that they have been, and they often get back in niggardly and low-grade ways, which are not too transparent or necessarily courageous. And I think there's a degree to which that has also occurred. The traditional male role models did involve heroic and self-sacrificial elements, even though, as in all human affairs, hypocrisy and venality doubtless played a part. But the degree to which many men feel relatively powerless in the present situation and somewhat embittered is again not a tendency that you can base political idealism on. People who are narrow-minded, feel they have a grievance and are embittered, may radicalise, but they may not necessarily be in a particular state to adopt a heroic attitude towards their radicalisation, which is ultimately what you want. I remember the late John Tyndall once said that you can never do anything with somebody whose politics just begins and ends with a whining about immigration, if that's all it is, because it's purely negative. When in fact what you have to be is heroic about your own nation, your own culture, its own history, your own ethnicity. These are the things that you have to be positive about. Otherwise, there is almost no point in being negative about the other because you have nothing to replace what exists now. I think it's also true of relations between men and women. This is a very difficult area politically because none of the mainstream parties, apart from acceding to the post-dated egalitarian attitudes of the past, have a policy about these things. There's been a left liberal drift in all of them now, bearing in mind the Conservatives would have at one time opposed quickie divorces, they would have opposed mass abortion, at least apart from a small minority of their libertarian MPs. Now the party basically supports all of these things because they're fearful of not getting female votes if they don't. And yet the irony is that men and women are keenly divided. On abortion, 70% of women support abortion, according to most deep Gallup polls, but 20% of that support is actually very, very thin. Men are split 50-50. These debates are very aggressive and very toxic. One of the reasons that mainstream politicians rarely address them, because these are primal issues, or at least they tend to the primal. And if you upset people on primal issues, they will never forgive you if they don't already accede to your notions and you've lost them in relation to all other areas of the spectrum. This is why immigration, the politics of the personal, Europe, and a few other issues are the issues about which mainstream politicians wish to speak least, because they are the most difficult, the most problematical, the most toxic issues, the issues that ultimately would galvanise the population to be interested in politics again, and that's why they're not mentioned. I think the feminist movement's success shows the success of cultural struggle, as New Left Marxists would call it. Cultural struggle is what this group and other groups like it are involved in, and is in some ways the only show in town for our tendency of opinion at the present time. Feminism has shown, if you go with the grain of a culture, as they did after the 1960s, what can be achieved by militant movements. Few women today know the names of the key feminist theoreticians such as Auerbach, such as Greer, such as Millett, such as Solanas and so on. Few people know their names, but the tendencies of opinion that their books influenced have proved highly decisive in the way in which people live their own lives. The trick is to have one's vanguard notions integrate with the zeitgeist. The problem is that the liberal society has probably not reached its apogee even yet, and is churning away and becoming yet even more radical and more deconstructive. However, all one can do at this present time is to put out contrary ideas. When people say that the traditional right wishes to subordinate women to men, the right has always traditionally responded that it's in favour of masculinity and femininity, and sees that men and women have fundamentally different roles in society. This is not enough for many contemporary women who wish to see a less patriarchal bias from what they perceive to be right-wing opinions. But deep down, these things are more powerful than reason. One of my principal views about politics is that people are attracted to politics only with a small percentage of their reason. The bulk of their attraction is emotional and pre-rational and irrational. And the more that you appeal to these notions, the more you will actually appeal to the generality of people. One of the most powerful political discourses that can ever be enunciated is traditional male and female role models, which are positive for both. This goes with the clock of biology and goes with the instinctualism of biology. Everything which goes with biology may be deeply unacceptable at the present hour, but it's probably the most powerful type of politics that occurs and that can occur. Lots of people will actually be quite impressed and emotionally entranced by the rejection of contemporary sexual political norms as currently perceived. But they will also be shocked and deeply scandalised with the politically correct and rational part of their intelligence. Don't forget, almost anyone who's educated now has been through the politically correct filter and only perceives reality in that way. Yet everybody has a prior, largely biological identity. And if that particular identity is appeased by image, by word, by association, and by the absence of grievance, then you will see people come to you. My view is that the more one attempts to rescue female and male ideas of a traditional sort from the maw of the new left and from second generation feminism, the more you will have the implicit and the intuitive support of generations as yet unborn. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. An intellectual prior positionist par excellence. While I hand this glass around, anyone who hasn't paid £5, you can ask some questions. So, first question at the back. Martin, please.
Yes. First of all, may I preface my question by referring to the previous speaker, Michelle Renouve. We've all heard my two objections to part of the content of her speech, I'd like to thank her for educating me on the contribution which the Women's Social and Political Union made to the subsequent fascist movement. That's something that I was completely unaware of, and I'm grateful for her to educating us all on that particular point. Yeah. So far as your talk, Jonathan, I've for long years heard right-wingers, nationalists of various kinds, equate the downfall of our society with general immorality, and I often hear the thing, or the downfall of Rome was caused by sexual license, depravity, blah, blah, blah. And yet in Rome, if you read about their culture, the Roman family, and particularly the Roman matriarch, was a terribly important figure in their culture, and not just at the higher orders, but down through society. Yet against this backdrop was the appalling, I regard as wickedness and degeneracy, of the games. Not just cruelty to animals, but cruelty to humans and the sexual activities associated with those, quote, entertainments, unquote. And yet the Roman Empire lived well. It became really great at about the death of Christ and went on for another 400 or 500 years. So can we really say that what, from a Christian perhaps point of view, we would regard as depravity or whatever, is a contribution to the decline of a society as such? Or are we barking up the wrong tree in trying to assert, because a lot of right-wing people don't tend to be very political, really genuinely political, and they revert to mummies' teachings or school teachings about Christianity and goodness, and that these are all mixed up, and that we're wrong to do that.
Well, I think it's the ethos in society. I don't believe, I'm a Nietzschean essentially, so I don't believe man's naturally good anyway. All societies will be partly degenerate and decadent. It depends what type of decadence you get. In ancient Rome, if you have an ethos of extreme socially authoritarian imperialism, and that's your ethos, you can have quite a lot of decadence mixed up in it. My criticism of the 1960s is not the decadence, which you will always have. You can argue about the degree. My criticism is the ideas which came to power in the 1960s and thereafter. Decadence is part of human nature. It's the ideas that you have about it which summon up what you're going to do and how you're going to live. If you're in command of an army, some of your best troops will have a private life that isn't worth mentioning. And every officer knows that. But you do not necessarily endorse ideologically what they do or wish to do as a norm and present it as not just socially acceptable, but that which is beyond criticism and indeed should become a replacement norm. I'm basically arguing for the element of hypocrisy that vice inevitably gives to virtue.
Let's look back further into Rome for 100, 200 years BC and study that.
Kevin, your question?
Jonathan, what would you say about the British attitude to prostitution? Because there's such a lot of hypocrisy and mixed values. On the one hand, we now have lap dancing clubs, which I've never been to. They seem quite abhorrent in many ways, but if people enjoyed them, they couldn't tolerate it in a civilized society. But then prostitution itself is illegal for women to form a brothel, which would be much more civilized, as they used to have in Paris, and before the Second World War, a very, you know, cultured place, so one could have conversation and drink, not necessarily. And then with men being arrested for curb crawling, the curb crawling syndrome.
Yes.
And where men are demonized for doing what comes natural, and it all is solved so easily by good legislation.
Yeah, but the politics of it is such that it never will be, basically, because there's no ramp of opinion which is agreed as to what should be done. And basically what you then tend to get is you have a sin bin zone in the society, the issue falls down into a zone, what the police call a zone of toleration, where all of the tendencies are mixed together. The feminist tendency that's deeply opposed to prostitution, the feminist tendency that's in favour of it, the liberal tendencies which are opposed to it, and the liberal tendencies which are in favour of it. If you regard libertarianism as part of contemporary conservatism, Tories themselves will be divided on these issues. Prostitution is always a very difficult issue. I think, but it will always occur.
So I just read an interesting book, Dan Cruikshank, The Secret History of London, you know, all about the sex industry. Yeah, it's gone over hundreds of years. You can see how attitudes change. One time, it was like, well, Amsterdam, with women in a certain part of London would perform in the window, and a lot more explicitly as well. You know, one moment there was a tolerant attitude, and next moment there was one more conservative and less tolerant, and it seemed like over hundreds of years. No, attitudes change. You know, it's like a cultural thing. It goes round in cycles.
Yes, that tends to the Spenglerian view that things are cyclical. And in a sense, one hopes that they are, because it means that our ideas are due for a bit of a renaissance.
Okay, good. Yeah.